You're listening to Web Talk Radio at webtalkradio.com for January 16, 2005, and my name is Ron Greenlee. We have a very interesting show for you this week. It's going to be a show that's just dedicated to one conversation, and unfortunately, Dana's not going to join me this week because we're dedicated to just this one topic, and that topic is National Public Radio and all the cool things that they've been doing online for years and some of the things that they're doing online today, which are really the focus of the conversation that will be coming up. Remember, you can reach me at rob@webtalkradio.com, and we certainly appreciate you tuning into the show this week. We are proud members of the Tech Podcast Network, and if it's tech, it's here, and the network has a variety of technology podcast shows, and you can subscribe to this podcast inside podcast.yahoo.com, iTunes, Odeon, Replay Radio software, and you can also get us now at Mobilecast at mobilecast.com. This show is brought to you by GoToMeeting. We'll be right back.
Todd Cochran here from the Geek News Central podcast. By now, you've probably heard that the Tech Podcast Network uses GoToMeeting to conduct online business meetings and training. But did you know that GoToMeeting is the easiest way for any organization to conduct online business meetings? I asked /.reviews Andy McCaskey what he liked best about GoToMeeting.
I like the way you could set up a meeting without cumbersome reservations. Just log on, push Meet Now, and your meeting begins.
Sounds too good to be true? Try GoToMeeting for yourself for 30 full days. You don't need a credit card. Just visit gotomeeting.com/tech roundtable or click on the GoToMeeting link on your podcaster's website.
You're listening to Web Talk Radio at webtalkradio.com, and my name is Rob Greenlee. Thank you for listening through our sponsor message that keeps this show going and alive, and we appreciate the support that you bring us every week when you tune into the show. Well, on the line right now, we have Maria Thomas, who's the Vice President and General Manager of National Public Radio Online, and she's joining us to talk about the whole area of National Public Radio and how long they've been online and offering streams and how they're funded and why National Public Radio started streaming a few years ago and how that really has helped them and been kind of a controversy for them with their broadcast side of the fence. Maria's going to go into great detail about the strategy that National Public Radio has for podcasting, which I think is fascinating. Maria, thank you for joining me on the show.
Thank you, Rob, for inviting me.
Well, here, why don't you give us kind of a brief background on National Public Radio and kind of, you know, how long you guys have been offering streams and kind of how National Public Radio is funded. Kind of give us the broad view of it.
Sure. First of all, I guess the first thing to point out is that NPR, National Public Radio, is part of a broader system that we sometimes refer to simply as public radio. And then together with our sister organization, the folks on TV, which is public television, together we're public broadcasting. So those are sort of the generic names, public radio, public television, public broadcasting. But to come back to public radio, within public radio, NPR is the largest producer and distributor of content, of which, what is commonly known as sort of, I heard it on NPR type of stuff. NPR itself is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and the funding for NPR, Rob, comes from three primary sources. The first and most important is from stations. The second is corporate support, which we often refer to as corporate sponsorship. And the third is foundation and philanthropic support. And you'll note that in my listing there, what was not present was government funding. Mm-hmm. So this is often a point that's confusing for some folks, and that is that NPR does not actually receive any direct support from the federal government. The government does appropriate some funding to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which is a separate entity, and that entity then does fund directly to radio stations, on average about 15% of their budgets. So one might say that NPR indirectly benefits from that to the extent that stations pay us for programs. But directly, we don't receive any funding from the government.
Oh, okay. So where does most of your funding actually come from then?
So the main source, when I mentioned that the main source is from stations, let me just go into that a little bit. And then I said the second one was the corporate support in the form of underwriting, and the third one is foundations and philanthropic organizations. Stations is the most important source of funding for, or are the most important source of funding for NPR. Fees that the stations pay to NPR for the programs that we make constitute about 50% roughly of NPR's annual budget. So you can think of NPR like a trade association in a way, where the members of the association are the actual radio stations around the country. So it's very important for your listeners to understand that NPR doesn't actually own or operate any of these radio stations. And NPR itself is not a radio station, but rather NPR is a production and distribution organization. So we make radio programs and we distribute them, in our main line of business, and we distribute them to radio stations and they pay us for those programs.
Okay.
So when you hear on the radio, you often hear support for NPR is provided by NPR stations.
Yeah.
Followed by some other things. What we're actually talking about there is that the money that stations are able to raise in their local markets helps them to pay us for the programs that we make.
Okay.
So if you're one of the kind folks who offers support for your local NPR station, that may be coming back to us indirectly in the form of fees that they pay to us for the programs like Morning Edition or All Things Considered.
Oh, okay. Well, that totally makes sense. Now, how long have you guys been offering streams of your content? Has there been any issue with you guys offering streams of the, of the content with your different radio stations?
Sure. I'll answer that in just a second, Rob. I just want to finish one thought on the revenue side.
Okay.
Just to make it clear, because this point is actually quite relevant when we start talking about new business models and sort of the future of digital media. To come back to how NPR is funded, about 50% of our annual budget comes from fees and dues that stations pay to us for the programs that we make and the services that we provide. Roughly another 30 to 35% comes from corporate support, and that's in the form of corporate sponsorship. Most frequently you will hear that on the radio. It sounds like support for NPR comes from Keene. We get IT done. So corporations are actually paying for that corporate support. And then we have, the balance coming from foundation and philanthropic support, outright grants from things like the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation or the MacArthur Foundation or Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, that kind of thing. So that just to complete the picture there, I wanted to be clear. To come to your question about streaming, NPR.org has actually been one of the early entrants into the streaming business. We started back practically 10 years ago with Real Networks when it was called Progressive Networks. And that predated my time at NPR, but there was early thinking around streaming and really mostly around on-demand archiving of programming on the website NPR.org. So if you look at NPR.org and you click on archives at the top of the page, what you'll see is that some of our archives now actually are going back as far as 10 years.
Wow. If you look at it from the perspective of the you guys are getting paid from the radio stations, then, where's the incentive for you guys to offer this content free as a stream off of the web here? I mean, is that something you guys have been wrestling with over the years here?
Well, let me clarify what we do have and what we don't have, and then we can talk about, what some of the challenges and opportunities are. What we have on NPR.org is an on-demand archive, meaning that users come in and at their convenience listen to what they want to listen to. What we don't have is any kind of live stream. So you can't come to NPR.org and actually listen live to something. So you can listen to an entire show, say for instance, if you want to listen to Morning Edition, you can listen to all of the components of Morning Edition, all of the stories from Morning Edition. It's just one right after the other. There's no sort of live host of the show, and there's no. It doesn't exactly sound like it sounds on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
But I think to come to your question. Again, this predates me a little bit at NPR, but from my understanding of some of the early discussions on this, I think there was some concern on the part of the stations about whether or not this type of programming should be archived on NPR.org and what that might mean in terms of folks who would otherwise, be listening to content on the radio. I think over the years, Rob, it's my sense that, we're all kind of learning in this together, but it's my sense, my strong sense, I would say, that the archive that's available on NPR.org is what I would call additive rather than substitutive. And by that I mean, all of our primary and secondary and anecdotal research would suggest that people, users aren't really coming to NPR.org as their primary source of listening unless they are out of the country, in which case they don't have a station, or they're outside of a signal area of an actual radio, an NPR member station.
Mm-hmm.
Usually what they're using the archive for is to listen to something that they somehow missed.
Okay.
Because they weren't, available at the time that it was being broadcast live, or they wanted to hear it again because there was some information in there in a particular story that they wanted to capture. Perhaps a friend sent them an email saying, hey, listen to this. So the kinds of use cases that we see repeatedly would suggest that these are not cases of people turning off their radio and turning on the programming online, but rather delving either deeper into the content or using the archives basically as a time shifting device, because of course radio is ephemeral and the web isn't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it certainly seems like that a person could really look at that site as an archive base. But you guys also have some full length programs on there as well. But most of it is pretty much like news related content, kind of sound bites. Are you guys looking at moving more into longer form?
Well, actually, what we have, which I think is really of value to all public radio listeners, mm-hmm. Across the country and across the world, for that matter. What we've done, which I think is our key value proposition on NPR.org, is we have taken the traditional long-form content that's produced by NPR, and we've broken that content into bite-sized pieces. And by that I mean we operate the website at what we call the story level, meaning that we sort of construct the website in a modular fashion with the story, each story acting as sort of the atom of the website. So whereas in the radio world, NPR is largely organized around programs. So, we have a morning edition team and we have an All Things Considered team and a Talk of the Nation team and, Fresh Air is a program. But on the website, we think much more at the story level. So the archive is organized at the story level. It's true that you can listen to an entire program once it becomes available, but really all that is a collection of the individual stories streamed right after another. And the reason this is important, Rob, is that this kind of approach has allowed us to organize the website in a way that we think is more valuable to online users, because the online user experience, the online use case, is very different, we believe, than radio listening.
Mm-hmm.
Where it happens, how it happens, people are behaving differently when they're interacting with a website than when they are listening to the radio. So to try and make sense of all that I'm saying, let me just give you a tangible example. So we have a lot of stories that are produced by NPR that relate to, let's say, books. Might be a book review, might be an author interview, might be the history of some, classic book. And those three stories, just to take that example, those might appear on three different programs. And one might be airing in the morning in your local market, and one might be airing in the afternoon, and one in the evening. It's possible that you as a listener are not listening, throughout the entire day and night. But it's also possible that you have a strong interest in books, and it would be useful to you if you came to the website and you were able to click on a section that said books, and there you will find all of the stories produced by NPR aggregated in an area that we call books. And it, you know, it probably doesn't matter as much to you as a user that one story is from Morning Edition and one is from All Things Considered and another one's from Fresh Air. What you care about is the actual content and that it's organized in a way for you that's easy to find. Mm-hmm. And I think that's been one of our principal achievements on the website, which has carried over into some of the on-demand platforms, is that we've actually created a system, an infrastructure, to create a taxonomy around, you know, this massive amount of content that's produced by NPR on a daily basis.
Yeah, it certainly seems like you guys really have a perfect platform for a form of distribution that's recently gotten popular called podcasting. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your download strategies and how podcasting kind of fits into the mix here? Because it seems like it could be a, you know, it's a real natural fit for what you guys are doing. And I know you guys kind of struggled with it for a while, but why don't you tell us kind of your progression around
sure.
that area?
Well, I think the key thing about podcasting, and by the way, I might interchangeably use the words on-demand audio or portable audio with podcasting, because to me, the real important trend or issue is making content portable and making it easily portable. So whether that means podcasting or whether that means making content available on a cell phone or any number of other, you know, distribution devices and strategies that are emerging, I think portability is a very key concept for NPR and more generally, I would say, within public radio, because a lot of our content is long form. Increasingly, you know, our audience is comprised of busy people who are increasingly on the run and multitasking, and as much of the world is, but if we can make it easier and more convenient for our audience to consume the content, you know, when they're walking the dog or going to the grocery store or whatever it is that they're doing, the portable aspect enables us to reach our audience on their time. You know, we've done the streaming for 10 years, and that's been, you know, we're very accustomed to the time shifting, but it's the place shifting that the portability mm-hmm. brings to the table. So that's what I think is the key driver for us, and our content being long form, I think is very interesting to start organizing in different ways to make it more consumable for folks that might be consuming it in very shorter time periods. And so our podcasting strategy has been informed greatly by the strategy that I was just describing on the website, mm-hmm. Meaning that many of our podcasts, at least the ones that are generated directly from NPR, are actually organized around topics or individual stories. So, for example, you know, the most important or the most popular podcast that we have in the marketplace today is something that's simply called NPR Story of the Day. And this is a single story that is 4 to 8 minutes in duration and chosen by an editor on my team. And the criteria is basically, you know, the one story that we think uniquely represents NPR that, you know, listeners must hear, that you're not going to get this anywhere else. It's not, you know, it's typically not the top news story of the day. And I think that the fact that that podcast is our most popular in the marketplace today tells us a few things. You know, granted, it's early mm-hmm. days, but certainly, you know, length.
Yeah.
Length is, you know, to have our most popular podcast be a sort of 4 to 8 minute podcast is interesting. I'm not sure that we can draw, you know, final conclusions from that, but certainly we're paying attention to it.
Yeah,
let
certainly
me just take one step back. Yes.
Oh, I was just going to comment about the length aspect of it. I mean, you know, if you look back at the roots of podcasting, it seems like longer form content is really what the roots of podcasting have been. But it almost seems like there's a definite move towards shorter form content, and I wonder, you know, if you can speculate, and I mean, I can speculate a little bit too on why that's happening. But is it because of just the abundance of content that we have out there, or is it just that we're starting to penetrate a market with podcasting that doesn't have as much time to listen to shorter form content? I mean, is that a natural evolution of this? Is it as we start reaching into a mass market that's what the mass market customer wants in audio content, is just shorter form content?
Yeah, the short answer is I don't know.
Yeah.
The longer answer is I think I have, you know, some thoughts around this. The first being that, you know, again, I just constantly remind people that I talk to that, you know, it's completely day zero in this business.
Oh, it is, yeah.
And I'm not sure that we're going to see patterns emerge that are useful for you know, some months to come yet. So given that it's early days and that we're probably still very much talking about an early adopter audience, mm-hmm. I guess I would say that I don't think we really have any mass audiences at this point. I think we have a lot of niche audiences,
yeah.
And to that end, you know, probably we can see all different, we can see all sorts of things work. So, you know, I mentioned our most popular is a 4 to 8 minute length. That's our most popular daily podcast.
Yeah.
Our most popular weekly podcast is something called All Songs Considered. And that's more in the range of about, it can be anywhere from 20 to 35 minutes long.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So, you know, I think we're, in the early days of a nascent marketplace, and I think the content will determine, you know, how long people will listen or how loyal they will be,
yeah.
they will be to the podcasts.
Yeah, it's certainly you know, reasonable to think that the content duration probably isn't as big of a factor as just people's, you know, desires to get to different kinds of content. I would think is the bigger thing, and how much they have an interest in it, will dictate how long they're willing to spend with it, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. Which basically always just comes back to, you know, is the content any good?
Well, yeah, and really, what we're doing by making content available like this is we're really empowering the listener to have total control over what they listen to and when they listen to it. And I guess that's the real, I think, more profound thing that we're seeing happen is that the, you know, these people aren't being programmed anymore. They're taking control of what they listen to.
Sure, and I think, you know, from where we sit here at NPR.org, you know, because of our experience with streaming and the creation of the on-demand archive, which I talked about earlier, you know, we felt like we went one big step towards enabling that control and convenience aspect, but the portability aspect of podcasting, I think, just, you know, gives it that extra oomph that makes it more interesting for the audience.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, downloads have been available, you know, long before podcasting, but it just wasn't quite as convenient.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the automated nature of podcasting does make it a lot easier.
So are you saying that your streaming part of what you're doing is declining because of podcasting, or are you seeing both of them just going gangbusters?
I don't think we've have enough experience in the marketplace yet, Rob, to you know, say anything definitive about that.
Okay.
The podcasting is certainly doing very well, and obviously, you know, we've only been at it for about 3 months now, 3.5 months. But you know, judging from the rankings on iTunes and Yahoo, mm-hmm. and other places, you know, we believe that our podcasts are fairly popular.
Yeah.
So I think we can say that you know, we will continue to try and invent and experiment with podcasting. Streaming, you know, at this point, the archive that we do online, you know, I really consider that part of our base level offering on NPR.org, and the usage of that, you know, this is not including podcasting, but just the on-demand streaming of audio files on NPR.org is around 12 million audio file requests per month.
Okay.
Which is how we describe it. You know, we have all these individual audio files. We don't have actual streams,
yeah,
per se.
Sure. So is that growing really fast for you guys, or I mean, are you seeing? I mean, what are you seeing happen?
It continues. You know, I wouldn't say that the streaming is growing really fast. I think that because we've been at it for a long time, we have a substantial base of users, and we see, you know, generally an increasing line up and to the right, but it's not like a, you know, a spike at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we've been at it for, you know, a decade,
a long time,
basically.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of NPR listeners are aware that the archive exists and that they can use it as a time-shifting device.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's probably, and now I'm just speculating, I don't really know this, but I think there's probably some additional awareness that is being created by podcasting of streaming. In other words, okay. That people who weren't previously aware that the archive existed might become aware of it via podcasting.
Oh, okay. So you're seeing these things kind of feed on each other and help other aspects. So are you thinking that the podcasting and the streaming helps the broadcast radio stations as well?
Well, I certainly think that the on-demand audio archive that exists on NPR.org is of value to all listeners. I mean, it's something that, you know, is accessible by anybody, anywhere, for free. So I definitely see that as a value add to the entire system, if you will. As far as the podcasting, I actually would like to go into a little bit more detail to explain more precisely what we're doing so you can understand how that relates back to the stations.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah, once you do that.
Yeah, one of the things that when you asked me, you know, sort of the history of our foray into podcasting, actually several NPR member stations who were really the pioneers in podcasting before we at NPR.org started doing anything. So back in the early part of 2005, there were a few stations around the country, most notably WGBH and WNYC in New York, KCRW out of Los Angeles. These are all NPR member stations, but in and of themselves, you know, they produce their own content locally, and many of them have started to podcast back in the early part of this year. So, for example, WGBH was offering up something called Morning Stories as a podcast, and these are things produced at WGBH in Boston. So really our stations had taken the lead and been pioneering in the space, and a group of them came to NPR in the summer, and we started talking, and they were the ones who had suggested that maybe together we could work on a project that would be more beneficial to the participants than any of us might be individually. Mm-hmm. So actually what we've done in launching what we refer to as podcasting, it's actually a bigger project for us. It's two things, really. It's we have launched NPR specific podcasts, like I mentioned, NPR Story of the Day and the All Songs Considered, among many others. But in addition to that, we launched together with our member stations a kind of experiment, if you will, on the business side. So this gets, Rob, back to, you know, some of your early questions about, you know, how is NPR funded and what's the business model. So what we're actually doing right now is we are experimenting with a group of stations, you know, a subset of stations across the country, on a model in the podcasting arena to see if, you know, we can invent sort of a new way of interacting with one another in these new platforms. So if you look at NPR.org and you click on the NPR podcast icon on the left side of the page, it will take you to a directory that says NPR Podcast Directory. And in there we have over 200 podcasts from NPR and NPR member stations.
Oh, okay. So you guys are actually listing podcasts that are coming from your member stations, not necessarily just from NPR.org. Okay.
That's exactly right. And I know that this is getting a little bit into the trenches, but I think it's an important point. Not only are we listing the podcasts from NPR and NPR member stations all together in this larger directory, but specifically we're working with around 10 or 11 stations now, whereby that group is providing to NPR its audio. And we are actually ingesting that audio here and sort of organizing it in a centralized database here. And then we are actually serving up the podcasts for that group of stations as well as our own, on the theory that, you know, sort of a centralized repository kind of approach might be a way in which we can have a better business model, both on the cost side and on the revenue side. So, you know, on the cost side, you know, we're basically looking for volume bandwidth buys. And on the revenue side, if we have all of this audio in a centralized place, we are more easily able to create inventory units around it for purposes of selling sponsorship.
Sure.
And if we do that, and if we're successful at it, and there's a lot of ifs here, of course, but the theory is that, you know, we can all share in what might be a larger pool of money than if each of us went off individually and tried to do all the same things. So, go ahead.
So would these podcasts be still available off of the station site itself?
Yes.
As well in combination with
absolutely,
with what
absolutely.
You're doing?
Okay. In fact, it's a really good question, Rob. To the end user, the end user will have no idea about what I was just talking about, because the fact that they're being served up from the centralized database here at NPR doesn't matter to the end user. I mean,
no, it doesn't. You're right.
The podcast, you know, let's take an example. So we're working with WGBH among many other stations, and if we're serving up a podcast on behalf of WGBH, that podcast will be available on WGBH.org, on NPR.org, through iTunes, through Yahoo, through Odeo. I mean, you know, our philosophy is, look, we got to make the users first. And if the user wants to discover the podcast wherever they do, it shouldn't matter. What should matter is that, you know, there's a consistent delivery experience, that, you know, it functions well. And that if we want to create, you know, like I said, a centralized source such that it's easier to manage inventory and to actually create a viable infrastructure to build a business on, that's kind of more of an internal issue. But it's important to the extent that, you know, I guess to summarize, I mean, what we're really trying to do is to build an infrastructure that will allow us as a group, you know, NPR together with stations, to build a business model that might actually work in this arena in a way that we really didn't do in the traditional internet space.
So would that mean that the local station could actually sell sponsorship locally and then have that play against their feed with you guys as well? Is that the kind of business relationship that you would set up, or is it, you know, you
no,
guys
that,
basically
that...
doing national buys for them?
Yeah, actually, so the idea is actually not that. It's that if we were taking a feed from a local station and putting it into the centralized repository, the idea is that only one entity, and in this case it's NPR, would be selling the inventory unit. And so if we aggregate enough audio, you know, the theory is that we can create different kinds of packages. So for instance, if you go to our directory, we organize our podcast directory in a number of different ways, one of which is topic. And if you select topic and you go in and you select music, for instance, basically it shows you all the music podcasts from across NPR and NPR member stations. There's probably like 15 of them.
Mm-hmm.
If in theory, you know, if we had access to all of those 15, then, you know, presumably we could start to create inventory that is, you know, agnostic of program and just starts to relate, well, you know, here's the sponsors might be interested in the music podcast or the books podcast or, you know, whatever. That's kind of the idea, is that the audio exists in a centralized repository, that we have selling group, if you will, and that over time, you know, potentially we could get more sophisticated over time. Right now we're not terribly sophisticated. In other words, you know, we can't target in any way or sort of geographically arrange things, but we're in the early stages of, you know, testing a new way of doing business together with our stations.
I would certainly think it's possible to actually do that kind of thing at some point in the future, especially when you start getting into mobile phone distribution and those kind of things where you can have some sort of location reference. I can certainly see that happening.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are you guys getting into creating unique podcasts that's separate from your member stations and separate from what's broadcast?
Yes, we are. And that actually is true on NPR.org and also, you know, in podcasting. So the general statement there is that NPR.org is beginning to create original content. And we've been doing that on the website, actually, for a little while, and now it's, you know, we're sort of growing that into the podcasting arena. And most notably, back in November, we launched a kind of a brand extension, which we called alt.npr, A-L-T.npr. And that's a name that's meant to suggest that this is a place where we might test new types of content, you know, new subject matter or new kind of approach to how the content is presented. The fact that we keep NPR in the name is also significant because we wanna say to the user that we're still grounded in the principles of NPR. We're still mm-hmm. grounded in the core values that define our programming. But we might actually, you know, play with it a little bit and perhaps have, try out different voices, try out different subject matter, try out different cadence, different tone, you know. We're not going to stray from the core principles that yeah. have made our brand successful, but I think you will see us test and experiment a bit here.
So why do you want to go off in that direction? What's the advantage that you guys are seeing with creating kind of unique original podcast content versus just using what content's being created right now with your member stations? What's the long-term advantage?
Well, I'll answer the question for podcasts, and then I'd like to raise it up to the web as well.
Yeah.
I think for podcasts, and it's simple. It's that it's reaching new audience.
Mm-hmm.
The idea here is largely mission driven. If I can come back to what's the whole purpose of NPR? Again, we're a 501c3 nonprofit institution that's organized to educate, inform, and entertain. are the verbs that are used in our mission statement. So, I think increasingly if we want the brand and the franchise to be relevant as younger generations grow up, we sort of, need to grow with the generations, if you will. So I think, introducing Alt is a way to try and test some new programming, also recognizing that audiences increasingly will be niche audiences. And so podcasting is a pretty easy way from a production perspective to test out niche content. But I think, the general answer is reach more audience.
Okay.
And that's very much mission-driven.
It seems like, there is a potential of creating unique content that you're creating content that would be more specific to a mobile listener or somebody like that that might have a specific need or a niche of content that wasn't being satisfied on the broadcast side.
Yeah, so I think that's right too. That different types of audience and then different use cases
mm-hmm.
will drive perhaps a need for specific kinds of content. So if you're producing for the mobile phone, one might be producing shorter segments or shorter consumable information, if one assumes that, at least for right now, the market for news and information on the mobile phone is really a kind of a let me catch it while I can type of experience. I happen to be in a line or I happen to have some time at the airport or whatever the use case is. So I do think that there's something to what you're saying, Rob, about producing for the specific experience as well as for new types of audiences.
Yeah, and as you guys roll more and more into podcasting, I know a lot of the podcasts you guys have on your site right now are, like we talked about earlier, shorter form content. They're basically taking snippets of information from your streams and making them available as podcasts. Now you guys have this whole plethora of long form content, full programs basically, that is not being made available as a podcast right now. What is it going to take, or is there a future way for you guys to make that full length content available as a podcast?
Yeah, I'm not absolutely convinced at this stage, Rob, that that's something that makes sense for us to do.
Mm-hmm.
For a few reasons. First and foremost, we have to. I think we have to work out together and in partnership with our member stations what the business model for all this is. As I spent a long time in the outset of this conversation explaining how NPR gets its money.
Yeah.
And I mentioned that the number one source is the fees that the stations pay to us for the programs that we make. So it only follows naturally that we need to understand and figure out collaboratively whether or not there's a business model around this, because mm-hmm. otherwise, you know, it doesn't follow naturally that we would just start giving stuff away.
Sure.
In one channel and charging for it in another channel. But even if we had worked that out, and we are, you know, as I mentioned, we are, you know, testing out a new business relationship with our stations. But even if we had worked that out, I'm still not entirely convinced that that's the right thing to do for a couple of reasons. One is that our programs are long form, and if we look at the two most popular programs in public radio, hands down, by far, they are Morning Edition and All Things Considered. Mm-hmm. Those are 2 hours each, and they're daily. I'm just not convinced that, you know, even if people sign up for them, you know, subscribe to the pod, you know, let's imagine that podcasts were available. You know, I don't know that people are going to listen every single day for 2 hours on their iPod or on their portable device. That's a lot of content. And, of course, there comes with it a big download bill for us, you know, a big bandwidth bill. That's a lot of content to be offering every single day. You know, it's 4 hours a day for the two most popular shows, 5 days a week, plus mm-hmm. weekends, an hour a day. It really comes back to what is the business model for this? What is the user, you know, sort of the most prevalent use case scenario? Mm-hmm. And I don't think, you know, we're going to be offering our flagship programs in full for podcasts until we get some of that worked out.
Yeah, it certainly seems like that you know, a lot of changes in the marketplace would have to happen before that really makes sense for you guys. I mean, certainly I can see somebody listening to that content if they view their portable media player as their primary listening device. You know, in the car or, you know, wherever they go, you know, almost like what you're seeing with satellite radio right now, where you have these portable receivers that you take with you in the car and then into the house. And you know, if for some reason podcasting gets to that level of distribution, I mean, even from the streaming side, I can see some play there. But it's like you say, I can see where you guys are like saying, well, we don't really want to, you know, undermine our relationship with our with our member stations. That totally makes sense. But
well, you know, I'm sorry to interrupt there, but I wanted to make this point, which is twofold. We're talking about podcasting and sort of, you know, portable audio, if you will, and a lot of that plays to our natural competitive advantage. Mm-hmm. And when I say our, I mean not just NPR, but all NPR and NPR member stations. Meaning that, you know, this is what we do well. We produce, you know, audio content. We produce stories in audible form. And so podcasting is sort of a sweet spot for us. It enables us to take our content and make it portable in a very easy way. To bring it back to the web, which I, you know, I don't want to lose sight of because the web in its current form or in mobile form, it has a huge audience, you know, that dwarfs either satellite radio or podcasting at this stage. I think, you know, this has been more of a challenge for us at NPR and across the board, you know, in public radio, because you're talking about something that's also visual, and that's not something that we're terribly good at. And we don't have a lot of history or experience with producing what I call visual assets, meaning let's take NPR as an example. In the radio world, NPR is most known for NPR News, I would argue.
Yeah.
And our franchise is news, and to a large extent, over the 3.5 decades that NPR has been in existence, commercial radio has kind of ceded to NPR that, you know, they don't really try to compete. I mean, they came up mm-hmm. with these homogeneous formats that haven't been successful, and in the meantime, NPR just kept getting better and better at what it's doing. And as a result, you know, I would say we're the de facto leader of news and information on the radio. That is not true online, right? I mean, online, if you look at news and information sites, the space is highly competitive, and there are many well-capitalized players in the space, ranging from CNN to the New York Times to organizations like Yahoo or Google, which really aren't news gathering organizations. So my point is that, you know, when we talk about, you know, what's going to work with podcasting and how do we organize business models and what's our relationship with the stations, to me, there's really a bigger question, which is, you know, if public radio wants to have, and, you know, here I'm being very specific by saying public radio, meaning NPR and the stations, if we want to have a meaningful presence online, and by meaningful I mean indispensable, in the same way that I would argue, you know, some of our radio programming is, I think, you know, we got to think harder. I don't think we've got that quite worked out yet. Mm-hmm. Podcasting, not to take it lightly, because it's been a huge project for us, but it's a bit easier for us because we understand audio. You know, mm-hmm. we've been streaming for 10 years. We've been archiving. We work with all different kinds of formats. You know, we sort of understand radio. It's podcasting is radio to go,
yeah,
in a way.
Yeah.
The internet, I think, is you know, anything with a screen that requires text and photos and increasingly video, things that we don't typically produce either at NPR mm-hmm. or at stations. You know, this is a challenge, and I think we've made our internet presence. It has been developed without the user at the center of the universe, meaning that, you know, there's a whole bunch of different sites. There's NPR.org. There's all the stations have their own sites. Some programs have their own sites. Independent producers have their own sites. It's really not that easy, frankly, to find kind of the aggregate of content in public radio mm-hmm. on a single website.
Yeah, but yet at the same time, that's the power or the reach of it as well, is that it's public radio and it covers a huge spectrum of content and distributors, and it makes it a very viable, very powerful, I guess, medium or type of content online. And it's, you know, from what I've seen, it's, you know, public radio has been very popular online just because it kind of fits in, at least it feels that it fits in with the culture of the online experience as well. It's, you know, it's that non-commercial aspect, which has always been very popular online.
That's true. I mean, I think that therein lies our opportunity.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess my point is that, you know, if you look at any particular area, let's take music, for instance, there are an enormous amount of assets that exist within public radio, not, you know, just at NPR, actually, you know, a lot of assets at the station at the local level that are quite unique and interesting and compelling.
Mm-hmm.
But you sort of have to know, I mean, you're sitting in Seattle, right? Unless I tell you, well, you might know because you're you know, you're an avid web surfer, but
yeah.
Unless I tell you that, hey, Rob, you know what? There is a fabulous station in New York City associated with Fordham University called WFUV, and they have, you know, one of the best folk streams online. Or that Kent State University, WKSU, has something called Folk Alley. And if you're into folk music, boy, I can tell you off the top of my head, three stations or five stations or whatever the number is, that do great work in folk music. Or, you know, you can pick anything. I'm just giving you that as an example.
Yeah, sure.
We don't make it very easy to make those associations. And I think because of that, we're not really fully realizing the value. And I don't mean financial value. I mean, mm-hmm. we're not presenting a kind of holistic picture of public radio online. And I think that, you know, I'm not suggesting that there needs to be only kind of one, you know, one mega thing. But I think that there's a lot of sites that exist on the internet today that kind of prove the value of aggregation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether you look at it as like, you know, an eBay model or an Amazon model or, you know, a Match.com model. I mean, places where people with similar interests gather, you know, to discover, to find and discover, and to learn what others are finding and discovering. You know, imagine if you were the fan of folk music and you were in a place where other people were already there, gathered, and you learned, you know, just kind of like you do at Amazon through user reviews or whatever. Someone said, hey, you know, have you seen this Christmas music special that was archived on WFUV in New York? My God, there's 3 hours there. It's incredible holiday music that I never heard before, you know?
Yeah, it's really a almost like a lost content kind of scenario where you're basically, what you're talking about is making it simpler and easier for people to discover content that maybe they didn't know about or was kind of hidden away in a corner because it was kind of geographically oriented because of the member station being so geographic. And so
you're
talking about pulling it broader, yeah.
Yeah, and that's a good way to express it because, like, the radio is inherently geographically bound, right? Because mm-hmm. you have to have a tower, and the tower can only carry a signal so far. Whereas online, there is no geography. And I think that we know from many prior examples in the web world that affinities are something that work online.
Mm-hmm.
And so we know that there's a public radio, a large public radio audience, that has a sort of affinity for the kind of institution that we are collectively and the kind of content that we produce. And we've tried, you know, to a certain extent, we are doing some of this already on NPR.org, but we don't have it, you know, as user-friendly and as complete as it possibly could be if mm-hmm. we collectively were operating, you know, as a system with sort of a different model in mind,
mm-hmm.
if that makes any sense.
Yeah, certainly it does. But I can also see, you know, some aspects to what your opportunity is kind of bringing all this content together into one place. But I can't help but think that somehow that could also kind of detract from the local flavor of that content too. And how does that kind of consolidation impact that local station? And I guess is this really a more fundamental question about the future of the broadcast radio piece of this? Is it, you know, are people going to be shifting more over to consuming the digital version of that broadcast radio piece? And I know that the broadcast radio piece isn't going to go away anytime soon, but is that kind of a piece of what could happen here as we kind of, you know, expose all this content to the online audience that kind of ultimately down the line kind of removes the need for the broadcast station, I would think?
You know, I don't buy that. I think that you just said it, and I'll repeat it. I don't think broadcast radio is going anywhere,
yeah.
Just like broadcast TV hasn't gone anywhere.
Yeah.
It's just changed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just changed in its composition and the viewer behavior. So I think we will see changes in how terrestrial broadcast radio is consumed, but I don't think it's going anywhere. And I think that stations, you know, for the most part, I mean, this probably isn't true in every market, but in many markets across the country, I think NPR stations are well positioned to be, you know, sort of important local community-based institutions, you know, in the same way that a symphony is, or that the library is, or, you know, whatever the important civic and cultural-based institutions are. And I think that, you know, stations will need to think about how to adapt to the digital environment. But I don't think that the creation of a more aggregated approach online would diminish that. In fact, I would argue that there are ways that it could be presented that it could enhance it. So, you know, a couple examples. For instance, right now, if you, Rob, are a generous member of any of the three NPR stations in Seattle, KUOW, KPLU, or KEXP, let's say you are a member of one of those stations, and then you move to Washington, D.C., as Americans move, you know, on average every 5 years.
Yep.
There's no way at this time for the public radio stations in Washington, D.C. to know that you are affiliated with public radio in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
So you move here and, you know, you're kind of lost in the system unless you generously donate, again, to either WAMU
yeah.
or WETA in Washington, D.C.
Sure.
So, I mean, that's an example. Another example could be that, you know, online there's no reason why geographic preference can't be sought out, you know, mm-hmm. from the user.
Mm-hmm.
And we would, you know, we could potentially ask the user to state a geographic preference. It may or may not be where the user lives. You know, these are just a couple of things that I think, just trying to provide tangible examples where
yeah.
that might suggest that I actually, you know, pretty firmly believe that we could create something that would only enhance users and listeners' kind of loyalty, if you will, to public radio and to local stations. I think a good example of this too is the is Major League Baseball, oddly
yeah.
enough.
Uh-huh.
Because if you go to your favorite baseball team website and type in Mariners.com, and then you right after that type in Yankees.com or Redsox.com. Basically, you know, they've sort of taken this kind of approach that I'm suggesting, which is they've presented each team individually, mm-hmm. but they're doing so within the context of an aggregated model, which comes under the MLB.com URL.
Mm-hmm.
And so each one gets redirected. But, you know, they've kind of leveraged their position in the marketplace by negotiating centralized services, you know, running things off of centralized servers, capitalizing on one user registration type of thing. So it's just, you know, trying to suggest that there are other models in the marketplace that have, you know, kind of local national structures, that we aren't necessarily the only local national kind of thing that has to struggle with this on the web.
Yeah, certainly it's possible to have a Mariners fan that lives in New York and a New York fan that lives in Seattle, and they probably want to keep up with their team and have some involvement like that. And I can see that connection most definitely. But why don't we talk a little bit about how you guys are working with search of your content mm-hmm. online? I know this is an area that you guys have been working with for years, trying to develop, because you guys have the perfect kind of archive scenario for a search engine, like a real-time content in audio content type search application. Is it where do you see that heading over the next year or so, or a couple of years?
Yeah, well, thanks for asking that. It's a very important area for us, and one that we have been spending a great deal of time on. I think that audio search and video search are going to be further perfected over the next couple of years. I think it will become commonplace for users on major search engines, Google, Yahoo, MSN, to expect that search results will naturally include audio and video assets, you know, and not just links back to text-based websites.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it'll be an enormous opportunity for us to direct more people to our content. And when I say our, I mean collectively across the system. A couple of things that we've been doing already, in which I think we've been pioneers. About 2.5 years ago, I think, we started working to convert the audio that's produced at NPR into text in near real time. And we did so at the time with a technology called StreamSage, which has since been acquired by Comcast. But basically, what we were doing was taking the audio as it's produced at NPR, running it through this sort of black box, and getting text in near real time. The text was not good enough to display on the site, but certainly it was good enough to index and use as the basis for search. And this is incredibly important because without that, the only text that we have available to be searched are the titles of the stories and the little blurbs that accompany the story that describe what the story is about. And oftentimes we would find that people were searching on terms that were perfectly natural for them to search on because they heard them in the body of the story. But for whatever reason, those particular terms were not listed in the title or in the blurb. And so a traditional text-based search would not pick it up. So we've been working in this way for, like I said, about 2.5 years. Now we're using different technology to do that. And we continue to convert, in near real time, all of the audio that NPR produces into text. We use that for our own search engine on NPR.org, and we make those indexes available to the major search portals so that our content will surface, when relevant. I think increasingly, as we look forward, that whole process will become easier, and it'll be even better from a user perspective. So if you wanted to search on a particular subject on NPR.org, we would be able to return to you not just the relevant, lists of the stories, but the actual audio, within, say, a 15-second range that contains that word or phrase that you're talking about, that you're searching for.
Mm-hmm. So does that range vary from segment to segment? I mean, if you're searching for a bigger topic, I mean, how does the search engine know how much of a segment to make available to a particular search query?
Well, that can vary by technology, but the short answer is that a lot of these technologies, which are extremely sophisticated now, I'm going to quickly get beyond my own knowledge base, but the short answer is that the technologies learn, and they will, you know, learn, you know, for example, how speech patterns occur across content, and our content is very well suited for this because, you know, we typically have, you know, kind of paced, a very well paced speaking on NPR, you know, on the programs and stories that we produce. But beyond that, I probably can't explain it more other than to say that these technologies are extremely intelligent. Many of them, the ones that we've investigated, have been used by or are used by the likes of the CIA when they're trying to translate, you know, audio from different languages even, and search for certain terms. I think that audio search and, you know, by extension, video search is incredibly important. And as broadband penetration continues to grow and people become more familiar with discovering audio and video online, that will just become a natural part of the search experience. You know, that just like today on Google, when you search on something and you get all these links, you know, it'll become very natural to have things separated perhaps by type of content.
Yeah, well, what do you think about the whole blended results aspect of this as well, where you do a search query and you get text links in Google and you also get links to audio? Or, I mean, how do you see that sorting out? Or are we going to be stuck in kind of a medium search engine? So it'd be like, you know, for text you search here and for audio you search here.
No, I don't think there may be a transitional period now where it's still kind of new to have audio and video search, and so they're kind of organized like that in order to get people used to it. But I don't think that's how it will continue in the long term. I mean, over time, you know, over a long period of time, this will just become the commonplace search. You know, having all sorts of assets in your search results will become expected and commonplace, and, you know, broadband will be near 90% penetration of all households, and people will just expect that. You know, and viewing a video clip or an audio file online or on your handheld device, again, I think it will become very commonplace behavior.
So how important are you guys seeing the whole mobile phone platform for your future? I mean, do you guys see that the mobile phone is really the ultimate in listening platform for National Public Radio if you look out in the future of what's possible?
We think that it's extremely important. And whether I would go so far to say that it's the ultimate, I don't know. I think that depends in part on how the in-car how the in-car audio experience develops.
Sure.
But nevertheless, I think the mobile platform is extremely important for us. I think that because, you know, effectively the mobile phone is nothing more than a storage device of sorts. And to the extent that user behavior develops around, you know, portable audio and the expectation that all programming is portable, if that's the one device that's going to win out in terms of share of pocket, then I think it's incredibly important that, you know, we should be present on that device, not only with you know, kind of the type of content that we've offered up so far with podcasts, but also it's a platform that's very well suited for something that NPR does well, which is kind of headline news.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is a product that NPR produces 7 days a week, you know, twice an hour, and I think that it's something that, because it's audio already, and that device is also oriented to audio, it feels to me like a very natural place for us to be.
Well, Maria, thank you for joining me and spending so much time with me talking about National Public Radio. I think it's a platform and a media content that I've been consuming for many, many years, and I appreciate all your guys' work in that area, and I appreciate you spending so much time, like I said, on the show here.
Well, you're welcome, Rob. Thanks for the invitation. And to all those listening who enjoy public radio, please help support your local member stations.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks, Rob.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
I'll talk to you later. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Hey, Rob. Bye.
Thank you for listening and joining us, and we appreciate you tuning into the show. And if you're a longtime listener, we appreciate it. Thank you. And we hope that you have a terrific week. And we look forward to sharing some more information with you next week on the show. And if you want to, like I said, send us a comment, we're more than happy to talk about it on the show. So we'll see you around the net.